in the medical legal system. Each case is divided into two groups: patients
who feel they have been wronged by medicine
and doctors defending their practice. These are their stories.
Our patient is a 60-year-old woman with a past history of CHF and emphysema who had been started on Ambien several days before presenting. A day after she started the Ambien, she noticed a 6 to 8 centimeter area of erythema on the right posterior thigh. Now, when she presented, she had normal vital signs, was noted to have a blanching of the ill-defined erythematous lesion of the thigh, but no underlying fluctuance or crepitus, and not even any tenderness palpation. The physician thought this was likely secondary to a recent prescription for Ambien, drew a line around the lesion with a marker, started the patient on hydrocortisone cream for a possible drug reaction, and sent the patient home.
5 days later, the patient comes back, this time to the emergency department, with a complaint of worsening erythema and pain to the right thigh. On this presentation, the patient was tachycardic, febrile. There was noted diffuse erythema to the right posterior thigh, and the clinician thought that the patient had sepsis, thought to be from a right thigh cellulitis. The patient was given broad-spectrum antibiotics, was admitted to the hospital, and blood cultures eventually grew out group B strep. Now, the patient had a prolonged hospital stay, was discharged home, but had several readmissions for worsening heart failure, worsening emphysema over the subsequent months, and ultimately died at home several months after the first visit for that initial rash. A lawsuit was filed alleging that had the patient been treated for cellulitis on that first visit, then all of the subsequent episodes of sepsis and decompensation wouldn't have occurred and they'd be alive today. Mike, we've talked about cases before where a patient comes in with, you know, seemingly a musculoskeletal complaint. They look well initially and then develop neck fash and die. And I think most of us are tuned into this idea that sometimes ominous and rapidly progressive infections can present atypically.
Well, this case is a little different in the sense that on the initial visit, by all accounts, the patient just had an isolated area of erythema and the documentation was pretty well done. The crux of the allegation is that the physician on that initial visit, like you're saying, failed to recognize that this was an infectious process rather than a drug reaction. So it might be tempting to retrospectively criticize the care during that first visit, or to think that somehow that our care was below the standard. In this particular clinical scenario, what seemed like a simple question, determining whether the red skin was infectious or allergic, is actually a bit more challenging than some of us would think. Now, on the margins, of course, it's super easy. You have a fever or a cut or break in the skin, or you just got stung by a bee, or you have an allergy to nuts. I mean, those things are a little bit easier, but the problem always lies when it's just on the margins. So we have some of these skin complaints, cellulitis or potential cellulitis, not an uncommon complaint. And when we're looking at a patient with the issue, the question is, are there any lessons that we can pull out of the literature to try to increase our likelihood of making a correct diagnosis and then subsequently staying out of court?
Right. I mean, I don't work many shifts where I don't see a case of potential cellulitis. I would have thought that this is fairly straightforward, but the literature tells us that that is not the case. And there are four themes that I think we need to consider when we're looking at something that could be a potential cellulitis. The first tip seems to be that skin and soft tissue infections can be tricky to diagnose. The literature tells us there's a really high rate of misdiagnosis. The most common situation is actually the opposite of this case, but it's when we look at something red and you and I treat it like it's a cellulitis, where ultimately it turns out to be what would be categorized as a pseudocellulitis. And the common players are venous stasis dermatitis, lymphedema can do this, DVTs, gout, or contact dermatitis. And when we look, the incidence of calling something a cellulitis that's not a cellulitis is impressive.
So Matt, I want to take a second and just sort of go through that differential a little bit more, because venous stasis dermatitis is so easy to just say, oh, the patient has swelling in their legs, there's that sort of dark colored skin, and this is going to be cellulitis. We'll start them on some antibiotics, antimitum, or send them home. But it's really uncommon, I'm not saying unheard of, but close to just happen to get cellulitis in both of your legs at exactly the same time. So this venous stasis dermatitis or lymphedema, I mean, both of those things are commonly confused. And when you just throw antibiotics at that, well, you're going to find that you're going to get other types of problems, whether it's C. diff or interactions or even just some sort of benign-ish GI side effects. The other one that you mentioned is DVT. So that's very difficult clinically to differentiate with unilateral leg redness or swelling, where there's a DVT underlying, because those can look identical. Gout, typically you would think would be more located to the joints, not necessarily diffusely on the lower leg, just for example. Contact dermatitis, hopefully you'll get that with your history. And then we mentioned it just briefly, but one of those more serious and unavoidable causes, the necrotizing soft tissue infection, like necrotizing fasciitis or necrotizing myositis, I mean, that's one we really need to make sure that we know that diagnosis, because of course, that's a fasciitis under the skin as opposed to a cellulitis. So what looks a little concerning on the skin could be way, way, way more concerning looking deeper under the skin. Now, you have a study by Wang et al. That looks at some of the costs as well as consequences associated with misdiagnosing lower extremity cellulitis.
Yeah, the paper came out in JAMA Dermatology in 2017. We'll link it in the show notes. And they looked at 259 patients who were admitted from the emergency department with the diagnosis of cellulitis. Now, using discharge diagnoses, they said 30% of these cases were misdiagnosed with cellulitis. So these were really pseudocellulitis that were initially thought to be cellulitis. In that subset of patients that were misdiagnosed, 85% did not require hospitalization. 92% received unnecessary antibiotics. And they do some number crunching to say, hey, if this is indicative of other shops, there are probably 50,000 to 130,000 unnecessary hospitalizations for what turns out to be pseudocellulitis in the U.S. each year. And they estimate that this is between $195 million and $515 million in avoidable healthcare spending annually. So I may not be great at differentiating between cellulitis and pseudocellulitis, but it looks like most of us aren't great at making that distinction.
And it's understandable because we want to typically default to the potentially more serious thing. But based on our segment here, legal lessons, right? The risk management issues are relatively small with this unnecessary prescription, especially if you think that you're doing what's best for the patient. I mean, there are various law firms that are looking for cases for patients who undergo sort of, quote, unnecessary healthcare. But these cases are pretty rare. And if you document and evaluate and do what you think is best for that patient, now again, not the bilateral chronic venous stasis type of changes on the legs, but if you think that there is some cellulitis occurring, well, I get it that a prescription for antibiotics for that would be a reasonable way to go.
Yeah, you're right, Mike. I think from a risk management standpoint, calling a pseudocellulitis a cellulitis is fairly low risk. Now, the authors of this paper say, well, look, if we mess this up, we could potentially cause something like 9,000 nosocomial infections, up to 5,000 cases of C. diff, and 2 to 6 cases of anaphylaxis annually. Obviously, none of those are good outcomes. But really, when we're talking about risk management, in this case, Mike, this was not a case of pseudocellulitis. It's the opposite, right? They looked at this. They said, this is likely a drug reaction. You don't need antibiotics. What do we know about when things go that direction? What happens from a risk management standpoint?
What do we know? Well, the really big question is, what don't we know? And that's a lot. I mean, when we see something red and we diagnose it as a non-infectious pathology, when it actually turns out to be an infectious process, this failure to diagnose is the most common allegation when lawsuits are filed. Sometimes there's timeliness of diagnosis and inappropriately performed procedures, et cetera, but typically it's failure to diagnose. That's what initiates lawsuits. And it's hard to quantify how many of these cases are actually getting filed.
Right. So the real issue here is that you and I can retrospectively look at this and say, well, now we know this was probably cellulitis on that initial visit, but we still need to really try to drill down on if the initial treating physician violated a standard of care, didn't meet standard practice. It's important to keep in mind that making a diagnostic error alone is not the same thing as committing malpractice. Now, the second tip that I found in the literature leads me to think that this patient, from their initial visit, had a decent chance of having a potential complication, and that this actually probably was standard practice. The literature tells us very clearly that soft tissue skin infections have high rates of initial treatment failure. There's a paper by Peterson et al., Predictors of Failure of Empiric Outpatient Antibiotic Therapy in Emergency Department Patients with Uncomplicated Cellulitis from Academic Emergency Medicine, May of 2014. They looked at 497 patients who were discharged with antibiotics with presumed cellulitis. 102 patients had treatment failure. And they said out of the patients, it's 185 patients who were discharged on oral antibiotics, 21% had treatment failure. If you look at the 81 patients who were given a dose of IV antibiotics and oral antibiotics, the treatment failure rate was 27%. And then if you had patients who were just given IV antibiotics and sent out, the incidence of treatment failure was 17%. They looked for predictors of treatment failure. So, okay, 1 in 5 are going to bounce back. Who are they? Can we predict who they are? Fever at triage greater than 38 degrees Celsius had an odds ratio of 4.3. Chronic leg ulcers had an odds ratio of 2.5. Chronic edema or lymphedema also had an odds ratio of 2.5. Prior cellulitis and cellulitis at the wound site had odds ratios of about 2. The thing that's really interesting is that in this study and other similar studies, immunocompromised patients, so specifically patients with HIV, cancer, kidney disease, and liver disease were not well represented. And in this study, a wide range of antibiotics were prescribed, and the MRSA rate in this patient population was 13.2%, which is much less than we'll see in most communities. So I look at this paper, and I think it tells us very clearly that this 21% failure rate may be an understated number when we start to lump in higher rates of MRSA in patients with more medical comorbidities.
Yeah, and that number seems high to me. In my experience, like every patient, 1 in 5 is going to bounce back because of a treatment failure for their cellulitis. That's not something that I've seen in my experience. And even the concomitant rate of MRSA is why some people sometimes are prescribing both, for example, a first-generation cephalosporin like cefalexin plus a medication against MRSA like trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. And I get it that sometimes we're doing that, but those are for those ones with some diagnostic uncertainty. This patient, and we'll get back to this patient in a little bit here, but one thing that was curious is the patient didn't return for 5 days. And I just can't help but think to myself that if we do have a failure rate, I mean, maybe it's 20%, maybe it's 10% or even 5%, but still a little closer follow-up for that patient or making sure that they understand they should come back to the urgent care or ED or wherever they're being seen. If they're not getting better or if they're worsening, if we'd have seen that patient on a return visit sooner than 5 days, perhaps we could have prescribed something different or admitted them for IV antibiotics and would have had a different outcome with this case.
Yeah, I mean, that failure rate of 1 in 5 patients, you know, we see it across multiple studies. I don't feel that that number is real, but it's hard for me to argue with the literature that we've got. But that number to me is high enough that what I've started to do when I treat patients with potential cellulitis is actually just tell them that. And I say, look, skin infections are tricky. The science tells us that there's a 1 in 5 chance that plan A might not work and we're going to have to go to plan B. And this is where I call it getting my own rebound. If they're going to be in that 20% of patients who fail their initial management approach, I want them to know that that's a possibility. I want them to come back to my hospital, see me or my partners so that we can come up with a good plan B. And that's both driven from a standpoint of optimizing medical outcomes. Like you said, I don't want you to wait 5 days. If you're worse in 2 days, come back. Let's get plan B going. But from a risk management standpoint, I want them to know that I care. I want them to know that I want good things to happen for them. And I want that rebound. I want that bounce back. I don't want them going to a hospital down the street where they'll say, well, that guy at that hospital that saw you seemed like a moron. So I've started just to talk to patients, and even patients who have low healthcare literacy seem to really get the idea that, hey, this is a disease that is kind of tricky to treat. And just because this antibiotic doesn't work doesn't mean things are horribly off track. Come back, we'll get it sorted out for you.
I couldn't agree with you more. When we talk about return instructions, one issue that comes up with cellulitis is this idea that a patient should come back, you know, if it's not improving, but also if it's getting worse. And so a lot of us will draw some sort of line around the margins of the lesion. In this case that we presented, the physician did draw a line around the lesion, even though they thought it was more of a drug reaction. as opposed to an infectious etiology. So, Matt, from a practice standpoint, I mean, you do a lot of work with wound care. You work in a wound care clinic in addition to your work in the emergency department. Do you find that this is a helpful practice?
No, I don't. And I've stopped drawing lines around things for the vast majority of patients. The problem is that we have no evidence in terms of how does this actually work. So if I draw a line around something in the ED and you get antibiotics, and then over the next 12 hours, you get, you know, half a millimeter of spread past the line, should you come back? Probably not. It probably is just taking time for the antibiotics to kick in. Yet if it quadruples in size in 12 hours, you should absolutely come back. I couldn't find a single study or textbook chapter, anything that tells us what degree of spread is worrisome, whether time or distance. So I just kind of broadly want the patient to understand that if you as the patient think things are worse, let's lay eyes on you. The risk management aspect of this is interesting. In this case, you're right, the physician did draw a line around the area. When the suit was filed, the plaintiffs took a really interesting angle on this and said, look, this doctor did not know what they were doing. They called it a drug reaction. They gave them a steroid cream, but they also drew this line around it. And that's a thing you would typically do for an infection. And they tried to spin this into, this was diagnostic uncertainty, because basically they're hedging their bets. We're going to do some cellulitis stuff. We're going to do some drug reaction stuff. And the plaintiffs were really just trying to create a notion that the doctor was incompetent, basically. And so I don't worry that drawing a line necessarily increases the chance of there being a medical legal misadventure. But in this case, and in other cases like this, it's interesting to see how lawyers will dissect every single thing that we document to really try to create the impression that we didn't know what we were doing.
Yeah, I've done almost 60 of these cases as a medical expert, and it sometimes is totally out of the blue, the stuff that a lawyer will focus in on. However, I will say that just hopefully damping down some of the anxiety that anybody would feel listening to a legal segment, it is rare that any of us will end up inside of a courtroom as the defendant. And it's even rare that one of us would lose a lawsuit, or maybe one during the course of the 150,000 patients that you see in your career. I mean, it's not a common thing that that happens. So the real lesson should be that doing what's best for the patient, maybe involving them in their own care, making sure that we document why we don't think those bad things are occurring, all those things are not only protective legally, but also when we do that, that's sort of like that hard stop in our medical decision making. We're like, wait, I just documented why I don't think it sounds like cellulitis. And actually, it sort of does sound like a cellulitis, or some internal conversation that we're having to that effect. So, Matt, just to summarize where we're at, that skin and soft tissue infections on the margins can be sometimes difficult to diagnose. Number two is that, at least according to the study by Peterson, that there can be a fairly high rate of initial treatment failure. And the important lesson that I take away from that is that that's why it's important that they follow up, because sometimes they don't get better and we want to make sure that they are seen again, or at least that they know that there's some diagnostic uncertainty, like you said. And then tip number three is that we really don't have a lot of great tools that we can accurately use to risk stratify patients with possible cellulitis.
Yeah, and that was a big allegation in this case, was that the patient had significant comorbidities, and the presence of those comorbidities should have signified to the clinician that this patient was a setup to have something bad happen. Now, they didn't back that up with anything. In fact, the best evidence we have in terms of identifying high-risk patients comes from population-based studies that say things like, yes, if you have an elevated BMI, if you're homeless or have poor access to care, then your rates of adverse events are higher. That doesn't help us get down to the granular level. There's an interesting kind of movement within the world of infectious disease that's pushing to treat more patients as outpatients rather than less. And that would support this idea that just because you have comorbidities doesn't mean we necessarily have to hospitalize you. The paper by Gunderson et al., Do Patients with Cellulitis Need to Be Hospitalized? A Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis of Mortality Rates of Inpatients with Cellulitis from the Journal of General Internal Medicine, 2018. And they said that overall, cases of cellulitis account for about 1.4% of all admissions in the U.S. and over $5 billion in cost a year. And they say if you look worldwide, the mortality for patients with cellulitis when they're hospitalized is only 1.1%. And in the U.S., hospitalized patients with cellulitis have a mortality of 0.5%. When you look at the patients who die in-house with cellulitis, the authors say the actual cause of death is not described in many cases, but is thought to be due to the infection in only a third of the reported cases, which is really interesting. So we look at those numbers, and those are much lower than I would have thought. I went to see what some of the guidelines would say. The Infectious Disease Society of America is very vague in terms of who should be hospitalized with cellulitis. And this is from one of their recent recommendations. They say, we recommend that all patients with cellulitis and systemic signs of infection be considered for parenteral antibiotics, which for most patients requires hospitalization. They also recommend hospitalization for patients with altered mental status, hemodynamic instability, concern for deep infection, and poor adherence, patients who are severely immunocompromised or who fail outpatient treatment. All of that makes sense. This patient had none of those findings. And so this paper by Gunderson et al. Concludes by saying, what are we really doing here for hospitalizing all these patients with cellulitis? We know that the reported mortality is low, the mortality from infection is even lower, and they compare it to a case of community-acquired pneumonia. We have well-done, validated scoring systems we can use to risk stratify patients with pneumonia and tell the patients your predicted mortality is X, Y, or Z. We have nothing like that with cellulitis, but the best evidence we have is that it is less deadly than other conditions like pneumonia, where we as a community are comfortable sending these patients out. So these authors really push strongly to say, just because someone has comorbidities, just because we think there's a significant cellulitis, if they look well, we don't necessarily need to put all these patients in the hospital.
You know, Matt, the obvious ones, and they say like patients with altered mental status, it's like, yeah, I'm putting that patient in the hospital. Hemodynamic instability. I'm not really sure how much, just like you're saying, how much this helps us getting these recommendations from the IDSA, because those are patients that I would admit automatically anyway. The bigger question is when you're at the bedside and you have someone that has diabetes, for example, and has a red area that you think is cellulitis, but they otherwise look well. Maybe they've had their symptoms for 3 or 4 or 5 days. They're walking and talking, you know, those are the ones that do seem reasonable to send home, but certainly having that documentation and making sure those things, all those ducks are in a row, is a good idea. So let's get back to our case. And in this situation, the allegation was essentially that on the first visit, the misdiagnosis started this course of decompensation from the patient that went on for weeks to months, ultimately leading to the patient's untimely demise. You know, my initial reaction to this story is that it seems hard to blame that initial visit for a death that occurred months later. I mean, even with a crystal ball, the fact that the care was delayed for 5 days, the patient still decided not to come back before that time. It's not like they were a nursing home resident with Fournier's gangrene who has dementia, right? Or that they lived on a deserted island and didn't have transportation to come back. However, these allegations are unfortunately not that rare. And depending on the exact circumstances of the case and the legal climate where you practice, these cases are sometimes vigorously defended or sometimes just settled pre-trial.
Yeah, the lawyers really go two directions with these kind of cases where you look and you're like, how is that possibly that person's fault? The first approach is this not feeding the bears approach, which they'll use to describe the strategy of fighting almost every case, even if it seems frivolous, to create a climate where it would be difficult and expensive in the future for a plaintiff's lawyer to bring cases that really have a tenuous connection between the first visit and the eventual outcome. And so that's why you see sometimes these cases are fought tooth and nail and defended. The other strategy is lawyers will, in some situations, look for cases that are fairly easy to settle. From a system standpoint, the risk here is that, say, the hospital decides we're going to settle this, then lawyers are going to pick up on that and they may bring more cases or be more willing to bring cases in the future. And this is a situation where the bears are getting fed. If they know they can get money through settlements, that's not a disincentive to bring a case for a plaintiff's lawyer. When we look at the individual case, the equation seems to typically be, would it be less risky financially to settle this and make it go away rather than paying to go through discovery, potentially going to trial? Personally, like I have been named to one of these nuisance cases where I saw the patient, they died days later, unrelated to what I saw them for. And the decision was made that if I could be dropped and the nurse could be dropped, then they would settle the case to avoid the risk of having to go to trial. So there are situations where they'll get us as the medical team out and then say, let's just throw some money at this and try to get out so we don't go before a jury and get some jackpot verdict against us.
You know, it's interesting to say that in this situation, with this specific case, there was a concern about going to trial. The case was in a small town. The family involved was fairly well known and respected. And the defense was worried that if things went forward, potentially the jury would offer a verdict for the plaintiff based on the patient's death and these other external circumstances. And ultimately, just like you had said, in this case, the physician was dropped from the lawsuit and the case settled for a confidential amount. So this case is a good example of a situation where the medical facts are somewhat debatable. However, you can understand that there is an allegation because of a misdiagnosis and obviously because of the poor outcome, which was death in the situation. And, you know, for all of us as bedside providers, while these cases can be hard to avoid, there are certain takeaways that we can keep in mind next time we see one of these cases of a patient who potentially has cellulitis that hopefully will prevent you and me, Matt, and all of our listeners, of course, from being in the same situation as this defendant.
Yeah, I think the three tips that we get from the literature are, number one, making the diagnosis of cellulitis really seems to be more difficult than we think.
Number two, that even when we make the correct diagnosis, at least according to the data that we presented, the initial treatment will fail up to 20% of the time, with the implications for us making sure that the patient understands the risk of treatment failure and what they need to do if that occurs.
The final tip is that the mortality from cases of cellulitis is fortunately very low. We don't have great validated tools to help us identify patients who are at risk, but if you're looking at a patient and you think it's cellulitis, and they look well, they have good vital signs, they understand the return instructions, sending them home initially on oral antibiotics is a safe and effective strategy.
So this has been another episode of Legal Lessons with Mike and Matt. And as always, Matt, I will look forward to wrapping with you next time.
Talk to you then, Mike.